Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Casey's General Store, for example, is receiving a $5 million grant, and they're going to be making improvements to stores across 75 communities in Iowa.
Iowa Rural Development Director Teresa Greenfield on Higher Blend's infrastructure incentives.
So anywhere from Atlantic up to Buffalo Center or Storm Lake all the way over to Comanche. And I lived in Buffalo Center for a while. That's up in the northern part of the state. I've got family and friends that live there. And I know they're excited to have these improvements made to the local Casey's because it's going to make a big difference to their family budgets when they're able to fill up their tank with a lower cost homegrown biofuel. Those kinds of stories are going on across the state. And Iowans, they appreciate a penny and saving a dollar. And so being able to access our homegrown biofuels is a priority for them.
This is Agriculture Today.
You know, I think this is going to be a year that we look back on as one of contradictions.
Ethan Lane is Vice President of Government Affairs with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association.
We came into this first year of this Congress with, a more narrow Republican majority in the House of Representatives than a lot of people expected, but still a lot of, I think, optimism for the year. We started with that, sort of unprecedented fight over the speakership with Kevin McCarthy going through 15 rounds of votes. We watched that, that House Republican conference sort of deteriorate, for lack of a better term, over the course of the year, with a replacement of a new speaker and that majority now down to two seats, in the House Republican conference as we sit here and talk, today. And at the same time that that's happening, we've seen an administration really on the march, under this banner of Bidenomics, looking for ways to fix markets and to create fairness in their words in the marketplace. We've watched new kinds of volatility in the cattle market as the expected recovery that I know our members across the country have been waiting for, albeit on the heels of a herd contraction that in a lot of ways hasn't been voluntary. If you don't have the grass and you don't have the rain, and inputs are expensive, you're shedding cattle you maybe didn't want to, but all of that has kind of added up to a year of uncertainty that looked very different than uncertainty we've seen in the past few years. Nevertheless, I think it's been a year where we've seen a lot of, growth in some areas as well. We've seen the launching of a variety of new packing entities around the country and new initiatives based on the investments from USDA and packing capacity. We have a lot of excitement around some of these new facilities and new arrangements with producers to market cattle in new ways outside of the big four, to find premiums in ways they haven't before. We've seen consumers continue to line up for our product, which is incredibly helpful. I think there's still a lot to be optimistic about as long as we kind of keep a steady hand at the wheel as an industry, and keep moving in that positive direction. The international community can no longer deny the efficacy of our sustainability efforts. We're the most sustainable beef production system in the world, and we're doing that, as we've talked about before, while turning out the highest quality beef the world has ever seen here in the United States. That's an incredibly valuable position to be in that didn't happen by accident. That happened because producers around the country have gotten better and better and better at how they do what they do, and maybe more importantly, better at talking about it. And that puts us in a phenomenally good position, regardless of what these folks here in Washington decide to do today, tomorrow, or into the future. As far as an industry, we're much more prepared to respond to that. We continue to be in a holding pattern on the farm bill. We continue to be in a holding pattern as we sit here today and talk on a government funding package that's going to keep the government open and operating. That includes a tremendous amount of priorities for the cattle industry. Hopefully some additional certainty if they can get it across the finish line.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think there's a more seriousness.
Arizona Representative David Schweiker.
The debt ceiling agreement, it was ultimately bipartisan. And it was because there was a serious approach to what's going on in the society, in our government. Unlike my brothers and sisters on the left, who just wanted to raise the debt ceiling and avoid the conversation. Much of my criticism before, when there was unified Democrat control, was the insatiable appetite to keep spending. Functionally lying to the American people, saying, well, if we just raise taxes on people over 400,000, we can finance things. And look, 400,000 and up in income is 2% of the population. We're not going to finance even a fraction of the debt, the borrowing, and the coming borrowing on that 2% of the population. It's sort of the political folklore so many people have run their campaigns on. And look, Republicans are sinners too. We often say, well, if we got rid of foreign aid or waste and fraud, every dime of foreign aid would cover about 12 days of borrowing. So yes, my answer is Republicans were completely frozen out in the previous couple of years. That's Democrat unified government. Now that we have divided government, if you're going to accomplish anything to the point where you get a signature on it, it requires, you have to work with both sides. And that's one of the difficulties for everyone here, because we all got so used to sort of the posturing of no Republicans ideas were going to pass, all Democrat ideas were going to pass. And now we're forced to actually talk to each other.
From a recent interview with Forbes on what Congress needs to be doing.
The Social Security Trust Fund is not magically going to heal itself. The new projections, substantially because of inflation, and you know my feelings that much of inflation was 100% set up by a combination of monetary policy and Democrat spending. But healthcare inflation is two and a half times faster than mean CPI. Meaning we're seeing some new calculations, like Bloomberg Intelligence last week said by the end of the decade, we're at 130% debt to GDP. If that math is accurate, that means over this 10 years, we will borrow more than all the publicly held debt that exists today. That's coming off the rails. Even Moody's Analytics has us at 121% of debt to GDP, 9 budget years from now. That's everything. That's what takes down republics. And yet we will sit here and do the shiny objects. And so you ask, what should we be doing with Democrats? Democrats own calculators. I don't know if there's batteries in them, but I'm sorry, that was sarcastic. This is the thing that will ultimately crush the poor, crush the economy. And the ones who really get destroyed are people who are trying to, survive, their retirements, have retirement security, and younger populations who are going to pay just stunning amounts of taxes. And yet, how often is this part of your interviews, your conversations?
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It's a big world out there, right? So, almost unlimited potential. And so we have to be very careful and strategic, right, with how we utilize our resources.
Mackenzie Bobine is with the U.S. Grains Council. She talks about growing demand.
We really try and look at almost like effort versus time chart, and then how big potential markets are, to see how we should go after them and where we should put pressure or apply opportunities.
We think of the U.S. Grains Council being corn, barley, and sorghum, but they also handle ethanol, and that's where Bobine is focused.
So for us, you know, we have a kind of tier one markets that we're focusing on this year. They could change, of course, given geopolitical environments, right? So just a couple years ago, Mexico and China were tier one markets, but they've kind of moved lower down now within tier two, just because, again, we kind of see some hurdles that are almost insurmountable in certain respects. But really excited about our tier one markets. So this year, we actually just moved up South Korea to a tier one market, as well as the European Union and the UK. So as we sit now, when we're talking about our export markets, the European Union is now our second largest market. So a relatively new market for us, I would say, too, only within the last like 5 years, but consistent year-over-year growth, record numbers last year, record numbers the year before, and they're on track to hit another record year. So we're seeing has more member states and just countries globally in general that are recognizing, right, ethanol has this viable decarbonization solution. So they're putting forth, right, like an E5 standard or an E10 standard or even looking at E15, E20 higher. So we're there to say, hey, you know, the United States has had this implemented really since 2008. We're by far the largest producer. We're the largest consumer. So let's learn from our best practices. Let's maybe learn from maybe missteps that we took, etc. But look at what we're doing here on infrastructure and feasibility, on low carbon fuel standard creation, on, you know, even like new best practices that are either coming on the farm level or what's going on with plant technology. And let's now broaden that and see how we can develop it for like your specific country initiatives.
Growing demand for U.S. ethanol has some challenges as well.
Probably one of the always the biggest hindrances to like market penetration would always be like a tariff barrier, right? And this is something where U.S. Grains Council has very little control, right, over like affecting tariffs. Certainly, we have great partners within the U.S. government, with the USTR, with the Foreign Ag Service, and we work hand in hand with them on identifying market opportunities and like a sharing of resources. But tariff barriers are hard to overcome, right? So, I mean, we are without a doubt, right, one of the cheapest octane sources on the planet, and we happen to be renewable at the same time. But even though we do have that cost advantage, when you add like a 30% tariff, when you add, you know, even like a 15-20 cent tariff, etc., whether percentage based or whether cent based, sometimes erodes those economic advantages that we have, that maybe makes us less, you know, incentivized for a certain country that's looking at it. So those are always difficult to overcome, but not every country has that, right? So again, going back to that effort versus time chart, what are the low-hanging fruits? What countries can we do now? And then maybe allocating resources down the line for some of those other countries that, again, are big whales, right, are billion-gallon markets, but they have a 30% tariff, but, you know, maybe we'll tackle that down the line.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Well, it was enacted in late 2020 as an amendment to the Packers and Stockyards Act.
Roger McCohen is a tax law specialist with Washburn University on what the Dealers Trust Act is.
Of course, the Packers and Stockyards Act applies to transactions involving livestock and poultry in interstate commerce that involves a covered packer or dealer or market agency or swine contractor or live poultry dealer. But the Packers and Stockyards Act basically applies to the larger operations. And there's always been an attempt, in recent years, to modify the Packers and Stockyards Act to provide protection to unpaid cash sellers of livestock to the smaller packers or feeders and brokers and small processors. And that's what the Dealers Trust Act is. What it does is it puts unpaid cash sellers of livestock ahead of that buyer's prior perfected security interest holders. So it's a provision like the trust that exists for unpaid cash sellers of grain to a covered grain buyer. And that was the whole purpose of the law, is to provide protection to farmers and ranchers that sell covered products to these relatively smaller buyers.
But has it been tested?
We've got the first test case that is going to test the scope of what the Dealer Trust Act is in terms of what is included in that trust. And that's a big issue, because if your buyer files bankruptcy and you are an unpaid cash seller, you're going to go to the back of the line. You're probably not a secured creditor. You didn't file a UCC Article 9 security agreement, and so you're not secured. And so if they file bankruptcy, the secured creditors, such as that buyer's lender, is going to get paid before you do. And there may not be anything left in the bankruptcy estate to pay you. And so what this does is it holds your funds. The idea is your funds that you're entitled to in a trust separate from the bankruptcy estate. And what the case involves is the issue of exactly what is the scope of the act in terms of what is going to be included in that trust that would be available for those unpaid cash sellers, and what is in the bankruptcy estate of the bankrupt feed yard or processor, for example. It's a big issue because there's a lot of money involved here. There's about $122 million in unpaid claims against three defunct cattle operations. And there's also a lender, a major ag lender, that says one of the feed yards sold about 78,000 head of cattle and didn't pay on the loan. And what these feed yards got into was a Ponzi scheme to the tune of about $175 million, a check-kiting scheme. And so this is the aftermath of that, and the courts are hopefully going to sort out who gets paid what, and we should know the scope of the Dealer Trust Act in 2024.
And what about a case dealing with equity theft in 2023?
This is a case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and resulted in a unanimous opinion from the court in 2023. And you're right, it came out of the Minneapolis area, Hennepin County, and there was a homeowner in Hennepin County that failed to pay property taxes, and the county followed state law and ultimately sold the property at public auction to pay the taxes. Well, that's fine. However, the county then kept the entire sale proceeds and didn't give back to the homeowner the amount above the taxes that she was obligated to pay. So in other words, they didn't just keep the amount that they were entitled to for payment of late real estate taxes and fines and interest and those types of things. They kept the entire amount. And her argument was, well, I'm entitled to my equity in the property. You can't keep that. And the Supreme Court agreed, and it was unanimous. And this is an issue that some states have, and they're going to have to retool their statutes in light of the Supreme Court's opinion.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
The thing that's also impossible to talk about in many ways, it's our demographics.
Is that what you would say is the biggest and most pressing issue facing the country today? David Schweikert from Arizona
It's a big word, but it's everything because it's the cascade of your ability to grow the economy. It's the ability to have innovation. It is the driver of almost 100% of the future debt, actually 100% of the future debt being healthcare costs, the collapse of the Social Security Trust Fund, those sorts of things. We in the industrialized West and the United States included have gotten much older. And yet it's almost the thing we're terrified to talk about.
He says it's pretty simple. Just look at the math.
If someone actually just reads, and look, it's one of the reasons I respect what you do so much is you're one of the few outlets that's doing sort of adult conversation, adult interviews. Much of our information we either get through our phones or we see on cable news is whatever the outrageous shiny object is of the today. What can we be enraged at today? Yet every single second, we borrow, $51,000 every second. And by the end of the decade, we're close to $90,000 a second. It's that is the greatest threat to this republic. But it's also impossible to talk about because the vast majority of that growth and that borrowing, that spending, is healthcare costs.
Part of the reason he says there's a growing disconnect between political parties and voters.
I think actually, if you really dive into the postmortem, which we have, you see a substantial movement of people moving their voter registration to independent. So they're annoyed with Democrats. They're annoyed with Republicans. They've actually become you see the growth of independent registration. We're actually even looking at our congressional district, and probably by the end of the decade, being registered independent may be my number one registration, not Republican. And so where I think there's a failure in your question, is, was it a blue wave or was it a failure of particularly Republican candidates to actually focus on what voters cared about? And this often happens to us. We have things we care about passionately. We talk about those instead of taking a step backwards. My congressional district may be the highest inflation in the continental United States. As a matter of fact, it is the highest inflation in the continental United States. Maybe talking about and fixating on how you're going to help on the gas and groceries and just the ability to afford life, you know, and your family and those things. So what happens when parties often become so focused on the issues they care about instead of the issues their voters care about? And in many ways, Democrats did a better job of talking about that, those stories, than many of the Republicans did. But it's interesting. It's more complex because the voters are a lot smarter than the political class often gives them credit for. You can actually see sort of the splits. So the legislature stayed Republican and some of the top offices were taken by the Democrats.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
As far as the offensive effort of the United States government, and by that I mainly mean USTR throughout the world, right now it would be IPEF, which is Indo-Pacific Economic Framework.
Andrew Brandt is with the U.S. Grains Council on what the focus of the U.S. Trade Representative has been.
That is a unique take on, or say, a modern version of a trade agreement, I guess you would say. Specifically, though, it does not include market access. Now, that's not all bad. There are a lot of issues, say, sanitary and phytosanitary, and non-tariff trade barriers. So, the really, some might say, boring regulatory stuff, or customs, as far as electronic customs papers. There are certain countries in the world where it's still all hard copy. If you want to deliver grain, you might have a stack of sheet papers with the regulations that's 100 pages deep in some of these countries. So there are still gains that can be made with an effort like IPEF. Certainly we at the Grains Council are constantly advocating for free and open trade. We believe we don't want trade barriers anywhere in the world. Our farmers are very efficient and competitive, and we are happy to go out in the marketplace and compete. But certainly, it's a never-ending effort to make sure we not only open new markets, but then there's also more modern times maintaining the markets we've built in the last 20 years as well.
And though sometimes it doesn't appear this way, he says countries that are competitors can actually work together.
As an example, in the corn industry, we have MAISOL, which is the International Alliance of Corn Producers. The countries in that are the United States, Argentina, and Brazil. Together, those three countries represent 50% of the corn produced in the world, and as of the Ukraine war, we represent 80% of worldwide corn exports. So we formed MAISOL. It was originally formed back in 2013, predating me here at the Grains Council by quite a few years. But the point of that coalition, it's the International Alliance, is there are issues that we are all in agreement on, specifically biotechnology, so getting the traits approved throughout the different regulatory bodies, as well as, more recently, back to the sustainability piece, our friends in Europe and some of their ideas around farm to fork. MAISOL can go there as a joint force of the joint face of the three countries with farmers. When we do a MAISOL mission, there's always at least one farmer from each country, and we show up and tell a story together about how in unison we represent 80% of the exports. Here's the technology we use, here's why we use it, and for anyone trying to limit that or stigmatize that in a negative way, there are certainly consequences. I mean, this unfortunate war in Ukraine and kind of how that's disrupted global grain markets, we have seen that we do not want lower yields. We want to have grain and food readily available so we can ship it where it's needed in the world. And so that is one of the things MAISOL has been fairly effective at since we have all three countries working together. That doesn't mean we don't compete. Certainly our friends in Brazil are having a good export year for now. I think that'll swing back, but you know, we do have to compete with them, and that's not just on the price of corn. You know, currency, which is not really something farmers directly impact, certainly plays a role in that. But yes, we compete with them, but we also work with them where there's common interest.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
When it comes to consumer prices for food and for most products,
it is typical for prices to fall slightly in December.
And that's what they did. Agriculture Department economist Megan Schweitzer says that according to the new Consumer Price Index, overall inflation for all goods in the economy during December went down by 0.1%. And for food, same thing.
Food at home prices fell by 0.1% in December. And prices for food at home or for groceries were 1.3% higher than a year ago,
which is an inflation rate far below the average yearly rate of about 2.5%. And in fact, for the 22 general food categories that Megan tracks,
we saw price decreases for 12 of them from November to December.
And several foods last month actually were selling for less than they did a year ago, including fish and seafood, dairy products, fresh vegetables, and eggs. Those egg prices down almost 24% from a year ago. Gary Crawford, Washington.